Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to today's broadcast. Great to have you tuned in. We've tried over the last, couple months or so to settle in on maybe around the first Thursday of the month, make it our program topic related to parenting. And today's one of those opportunities. And looking forward to getting today's guest on. And Ted, I was thinking, I was reading and preparing for today's interview that we've all had times when the question came up, what were you thinking?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah,
with the kids.
And
trying to think.
And it usually ends with, well, you weren't thinking, yeah. Right?
And I won't name them. They're all adult children now. But there was one of my children once that decided with a couple of friends that they wanted to go to the beach, but they actually wanted to go to the ocean beach.
Oh.
Which, you know, living
the
in the
beach.
Living in the other upper Midwest. It was, so they just took the car and took off. And it's kind of like a...
Oh, wow.
A couple of days later, they were in college at the time.
Okay.
But still, it was...
Wow.
Oh, really? You, drove 24 hours?
Man, they did. They went to the coast.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, and then they discovered that Virginia Beach wasn't really as warm as Daytona Beach. So it's like, hey, never mind. I'm not going to tell stories my kids. We'll get to your kids first, because that'll be more fun when we tell kids stories about your kids.
Oh, I thought you were talking to the audience.
Yeah, no, sure. No,
we'd be here a while.
Sure. Well, Dr. David Walsh is back with us here on Connecting Faith. His book was a bestseller when it first came out back in, 1990s, I think it was. Why Do They Act That Way? It's a survival guide to the adolescent brain for you and your team. Well, it's been revised and updated here a couple of years ago, and we just want to have Dr. Walsh on because this is an important topic, brain development and understanding. We've got much more topic than we have time to cover today, but let me just introduce our guest and we'll get him on right away. David Walsh is one of the world's leading authorities on children, teens, parenting, family life, and the impact of technology on children's health and development. He spent a number of years teaching and coaching high school students before joining Fairview Health Services in Minneapolis to develop and direct innovative counseling programs for youth and families. And then back in 1995, Dr. Walsh founded the internationally renowned National Institute on Media and the Family, which he led up until just a few years ago. And he recently founded Mind Positive Parenting to help caring adults better understand how to help kids thrive in the 21st century. And he and his wife, Monica, have three adult children and now seven grandchildren. We're going to swap grandchildren stories if we run out of time, but... Why Do They Act That Way? One of his bestsellers, and then one of a great number of his books, Know, Why Kids of All Ages Need to Hear It, and Ways Parents Can Say It, and also Smart Parenting, Smarter Kids, the one brain book you need to help your child grow brighter, healthier, and happier. So we're going to talk brains today, teen, adolescent brains particularly. Dr. Walsh, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
It is always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with, there's all sorts of new research. You've been studying this area for a long time, but one of the things, by the way, I do have a copy of David's book, Why Do They Act That Way? We're going to give that away at the end of the hour. And if you have a question about your adolescence, your child's activity and behavior, and you'd like to weigh in, get your questions queued up right away, you can call us at 877-93-FAITH. David, one of the things you say early on in the book, and I know I've heard you say it before, is that neurons that fire together wire together. Well, let's talk about what do we need to understand about the brain and how it works?
Well, you know, first of all, the miracle that God created called the brain is absolutely amazing. So a newborn baby arrives with about 100 billion brain cells or neurons, each with about 10,000 branches, meaning the possible number of connections in a newborn baby's brain is about 1 quadrillion connections. But when that baby is born, only about 17% of those brain cells are wired together. And so then what follows in the days, the weeks, the months, the years, and as we'll talk about today, even the decades that follow, the rest of those billions and billions of brain cells wire together. Now, the wiring is driven by two forces, of course. One is genetics, which I like to think of as the hard wiring. But in addition to the hard wiring, we have the soft wiring. What's that? The experiences that we have. And experiences are critically important, and that's where the phrase that you mentioned, the neurons that fire together, wire together, comes in. Whatever brain cells fire together, those are the ones that get wired. And, you know, another way to think about that is that whatever the brain does a lot of is what the brain gets good at. So God created the brain to be remarkably adaptable to the world in which it finds itself. So whatever the brain does a lot of is what the brain gets good at. So if the brain does a lot of math, it tends to get good at math. If the brain does a lot of tennis, it tends to get good at tennis. If the brain does a lot of texting, it tends to get really good at texting or video games. And, of course, we can also spin that positively. When the brain does a lot of self-discipline, patience, respect for others, those are the circuits that get wired as well.
It is a muscle, right? I mean, we can maybe just – you know, we don't have to get into detail.
It's not technically a muscle, but it's a good analogy. Okay. It's a very good analogy to use because although it's not a muscle, it's an organ, it does function as a muscle. In other words, whatever connections we make are the ones that tend to get stronger and stronger.
Okay. Is there actually brain food or exercises that we can do to strengthen our brains?
We're going to have a lot of good conversation today. You know, it turns out that even the word brain food makes sense because, you know, even though the brain only takes up about 2% of the body's weight and mass, it consumes more than 20% of the brain's energy. And so it is master control for everything that goes on. And so literally the fuel that we provide for master control becomes very important. And so, yes, we now know more about diet and how diet affects the brain functioning. We know a lot more about how exercise affects the brain functioning. And by the way, the impact is very, very positive. So when we tell kids, you know, get out and run around and get some exercise, it's not just for healthy muscles and bones and cardiovascular system that we all know about. It's actually for a healthy brain. Another thing that's very important for brain function, so to speak, is sleep and making sure kids get enough sleep. So, you know, all of those things become kind of brain food, as well as, of course, the experiences that we provide them with.
We'll cycle back, talk a little bit more about sleep as we go along, but maybe just some. We're talking about why do they act that way, survival guide to the adolescent brain for you and your teen. And if you've ever asked that question, what were they thinking, then this is your program today. 877-933-2484 is the number to call and ask your question or comment. So are there significant differences between the male and female brain, and maybe as they grow through adolescence, how it changes?
Yeah, absolutely there are. And this is, of course, a little bit of a tricky area because, you know, a lot of the information between male and female brains has been misused in the past. So, you know, 150 years ago when scientists discovered that the male brain was a little bit larger, even accounting for body size, they concluded, well, that shows that men are more intelligent, and that's why women shouldn't be able to vote or hold positions of authority, which, of course, is ridiculous. You know, if brain size was a measure of intelligence, whales would rule the world, and, you know, we're not ruled by whales. So, but that said, because of all of the brain imaging technology that is now available, we can actually see that there are differences between boy brains and girl brains. Now, different doesn't mean better or worse. It just means different. And, you know, we could talk for a long time about what some of those differences are, but let me give you one example. The female brain, a girl's brain, is designed by God to have some brain-based advantage when it comes to language. And so the language areas of the brain, for example, are more densely packed with brain cells in girls' brains than boys' brains, which might explain why girls on average tend to talk before little boys do. why boys are much more likely to have stuttering or reading problems than girls. And even at the other end of the lifespan, if a man and a woman both suffer a stroke later in life and that stroke affects their language areas, a woman is much more likely to regain language than a man. So there are lots of behavioral indications that the female brain has some brain-based advantage when it comes to language. Now, of course, we're talking averages. So, you know, we're not talking about everyone. We're talking about averages. So as soon as I say, well, the female brain might have a brain-based advantage to language, one of your listeners might say, now, wait a minute. William Shakespeare was a man. He didn't seem to lack in language ability. And so there are a million exceptions, a bajillion exceptions. But in general, the female brain has some brain-based advantage for language. Now, that turns up in school. That turns up in the way kids navigate adolescence. So girls are much more likely to talk about what's going on inside. Boys are a little bit more likely to kind of keep the door shut. So a lot of those brain-based differences show up in the behavior.
We'll get into that in the moments ahead as we continue our conversation with Dr. David Walsh. We're reflecting on his best-selling book, Why Do They Act That Way? A Survival Guide to the Adolescent Brain for You and Your Teen. And it's just fascinating reading and good insight from Dr. David Walsh, who is one of the world's leading authorities on children, teens, parenting, family life, and impact of technology in child's health, and has founded recently Mind Positive Parenting to help caring adults better understand how to help kids thrive in the 21st century. And it's working with brain science and developing digital literacies and preparing children and youth for global competition, cooperation, and a number of other things. We'll get to today's discussions a little bit more in depth in just a moment. We'll talk about blossoming and pruning and about windows of opportunity and, you know, just why do smart kids do dumb things? We'll get to that and more. We'd love to take your questions, too. You have a question, a parenting-related question, you can call us at 877-933-2484. It's 877-933-2484. Or you may want to connect with us online. You go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email link there. You can send your question in that way. And we'll talk to Dr. David Walsh in a moment.
Work. What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain.
Now, our kids do have brains. We like them to use it a little bit more. That's a classic. We're talking brain development and, in fact, some of the understanding the research behind what's going on in our adolescent's mind. Why do they act that way? It's the title of the best-selling book from Dr. David Walsh. He wrote it here a number of years ago and revised it here a few years ago as well. And Dr. Walsh, of course, presents workshops to parents, educators, and professionals throughout the world and has founded Mind Positive Parenting. He directed the National Institute on Media and the Family for a number of years and has written some best-selling books, and we've got a copy of Why Do They Act That Way. We'll give that away here at the end of the hour. If you'd like to sign up for the drawing for that, it's 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH, and feel free to ask a question as well. We go along. So we're talking about brain development. You discuss blossoming and pruning in the adolescent brain. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's another good question. I have a sneaky suspicion all of your questions are going to be good ones. it turns out that even though the brain doesn't develop all of its specific circuits at the same time, while some are a little bit more active, others are less active. And what happens during a brain's growth spurt is that the branches at the end of the brain cell start to sprout like crazy. And that's what's called blossoming. And that's not my nickname. That's actually the term that that neuroscientists around the world use. And then experience goes to work. The ones that fire get wired into networks. The ones that don't fire wither back and die, a process that's called pruning. And so the growth spurt of the brain is this process of blossoming and pruning, blossoming and pruning. But what's important to remember about that is that the experiences that we have during those growth spurts, during those blossoming and pruning periods, are actually more important than some other times in our life. So, for example, let me give you an example early in life. Some of the circuits that are very, very active in a little baby's brain are circuits for what's called phonemic awareness. Now, what is that? Well, when we're born, we're citizens of the world. We can learn any language. And then based on the sounds that I hear, my brain starts to wire to recognize different sounds. So some of your listeners may remember from high school physics that sound comes in waves of different frequencies. So the frequency of the S, as in Sam, is a much higher frequency than the frequency of M, as in Mary. Well, as the baby starts to hear those different sounds, some brain cells get assigned to one frequency, others get assigned to a different frequency. We now know that the growth spurt, that the window of opportunity to wire that in, is actually open widest in the first 3 years of life. So as the baby starts to hear different sounds, they start to be able to distinguish the sound of a B from a D, for example. Now, that's not just kind of interesting science. That has tremendous implications because we now know that one of the strongest predictors of reading ability in school is the amount of one-to-one conversation between caregivers and babies in the early years of their life, because phonemic awareness is the basic building block for reading. See, you know, what is reading? When I'm 6 or 7 or 8 years old and I'm trying to learn how to read, learning how to read is associating blots of ink on a page with sounds. If I come into that process with a rich wet network for phonemic awareness, then the process of learning how to read is going to be easier for me than if I don't. So, you know, one of the important things is to take this brain science that we're talking about and, of course, translate it into, okay, so what do we do? So in this example, the recipe for success is to talk. read. And we need to make sure that parents of newborn babies understand that the conversations they're having, even before the baby can respond, are very, very important to kind of wire those circuits that are going to be important for their success. Now, you know, when you translate that into the adolescent brain, the growth spurts that are going on in the adolescent brain have to do with impulse control, risk assessment, those things. So once again, the experiences that we have a tremendous impact for later on in life.
So is that, as you talk about a window of opportunity, is if a child misses one, does that mean it's closed? Because there's also, you know, you talk about use it or lose it. I mean, is that actually
right,
true in the brain?
It's not so much that the window is closed, but it makes the hill to climb a lot steeper.
Hmm.
And so that might be the way to look at it. One of the miracles of the brain, and of course it is one of God's greatest creations, is that, you know, we never say never, but you know, if children miss experiences during some of those critical windows of opportunity, then making that up becomes a little bit more difficult. Not impossible, but more difficult.
Does maybe, I don't know if it's a sidetrack, but lots of interest in baby videos and sort of multimedia use. You know, let's talk about sort of the media exposure. I mean, you've been an advocate about talking about media for many years. So a good thing, bad thing?
Well, you know, media and technology are such a part of our lives that I think the thing to remember is that it's neither good nor bad, but it is very, very powerful. We're using technology right now to have this conversation with thousands and thousands of your listeners. So the technology can be used for very, very positive things. And of course, the technology can also be misused. What we know about young children, to get more to your question, what we know about young children is that there is no substitute for face-to-face real-world experiences. Media and technology cannot duplicate that. And so, you know, you get these products. People are always, you know, a lot of marketers realize that there's a lot of interest in the brain. And so if they attach any kind of brain words to their product, then somehow they're kind of communicating that it is really, really good for children. And so you get products like Baby Einstein videos. Smartest thing about the product, in my estimation, is the name, Promising Einstein. You know, Promising Genius. Well, who wouldn't want that for the little boy and girl? But, you know, there is no evidence that, you know, those early kind of products aimed at the little ones really provide them any benefit at all. In fact, there is some research actually pointing in the opposite direction, which is why I and many, many others recommend very, very limited media, if any at all, for babies younger than two, because they should be having all of those experiences. And then between the age of two and then preschool, probably no more than an hour a day. And then once they get into school, no more than 2 hours a day. So it can be part of their activity diet, but for too many kids, it gets way out of balance, and we may end up talking about that a little bit more during the time that we have left. Sure.
Well, maybe let's just jump ahead then to the adolescent who is screen time all the time.
I thought you were going to go there.
Yeah, sort of lost all their social skills to look anybody in the eye. So, yeah.
Well, you know, what you just said actually now is backed up by research. So here's one of the things that's happening. As this technological revolution continues to kind of move along at lightning speed, so, you know, if we blink, everything changes. You know, so the things that sat on our desk just, you know, a decade ago, we now carry around in our pockets. And so this technology is everywhere, and the kids have taken to it big time. So the use of media and technology, every time we do a study, the number of hours that kids, particularly the preteens and teenagers, are spending with television, video games, smartphones, cell phones, Facebook, the amount of time per day keeps going up and up and up. And so now for the average American kid, particularly in those preteen and teenage years, it exceeds 50 hours a week. And so they are spending more time with the technology than in any other activity of their waking life. And for some kids, it literally takes over their life. But if we go back to the same principle that we talked about 20 minutes ago, whatever the brain does a lot of is what the brain gets good at. It turns out, and I'm going to pick up on the comment that you made, which was very, very astute, it turns out that we don't automatically get good at face-to-face communication. It takes practice. It takes practice to kind of read and interpret correctly nonverbal cues. It takes practice to communicate when communication gets a little bit tricky, when there's conflict or disagreement or difference of opinion. We get good at that by doing it. And the research now is building that the heavy technology users are showing a deficit in real-world communication skills. And the reason is because they aren't doing it enough. They're spending so much time communicating electronically that they're not doing it face-to-face. And for all of the kids who can multitask, and there was a study done at Stanford University in which they found that 99%, so almost universal, of the undergrads reported that they multitask. In other words, they're doing two things with technology simultaneously. Well, whatever the brain does a lot of is what the brain gets good at. So what's the impact of that? What the impact of that is that kids are literally training their brains to not focus attention, to be constantly shifting attention. Only focus attention on one thing at a time.
Let me jump in there, and we'll come back, talk more about multitasking and more. Dr. David Walsh talking about brain development here on Connecting Faith. Stay tuned. Probably experienced that raising your kids, or maybe you're in the middle of that right now, and the question has come up, why do they act that way? You know, why do Why do smart kids do dumb things? We're getting some good insight today from leading expert Dr. David Walsh, who is one of the world's leading authorities on children, teens, parenting, family life, and the impact of technology on children's health and development, and has focused on brain science for a number of years, written the several best-selling books. The one that we're referencing today is called Why Do They Act That Way? The subtitle is A Survival Guide to the Adolescent Brain for You and Your Teen. Originally came out 10 years ago, was just updated last year. We've got a copy we'll give away here at the end of the hour. If you'd like to be in the drawing for that, you're welcome to call us at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question or comment, too, we'd love to have you join the broadcast. By the way, if you want to find out more about Dave Walsh, you can go to his website, Dr. Dave Walsh. That's drdavewalsh.com. And there's got a lot of information. We'll talk about that as well. He and his wife founded Mind Positive Parenting here not long ago, and that's where he spends a lot of his time and effort. So, David, we're talking before the break a little bit about multitasking. Can kids multitask, and is it a problem if they do?
Young kids tell me, the high school kids tell me, well, Dr. Walsh, you can't multitask because you're an old guy. But we can do it because we've grown up doing it. Well, it turns out that they can't do it either. They think they can, but actually our brain is built in such a way that we can focus attention only on one thing at a time. Now, can we do two things simultaneously? Yes, if one of them doesn't take focused attention. So you and I might, you know, go for a car ride, and I've been driving a car for many, many years, well over 50 years. And, you know, I could drive a car, which is a very complicated process, and I could carry on a conversation with you at the same time. That's multitasking. However, if we got into heavy traffic, the weather turned bad, and I was in a part of the city that I wasn't familiar with, what would I have to do? I'd have to say, I can't talk right now. I need to pay attention. We can only concentrate or pay attention on one thing at a time. So the research is clear that we, and that includes young people, when we multitask, we lose speed, we lose accuracy, and we lose efficiency. Because what we're doing is we're constantly shifting and restarting. Which is why, for example, the insurance companies know this very, very well, which is why they are trying to get all the laws passed to prevent people from driving while they're using their cell phones, even talking, texting. Texting and driving is practically a recipe for a serious accident. There was a tragic story just in this morning's paper here in the Twin Cities in Minnesota about a Wisconsin man who was texting while driving. The accident ended up killing two of his children. Just tragic stories. This whole distracted driving thing, you see people walking down the street trying to multitask and they bump into other people or bump into a telephone pole. Our brains are only built for one thing at a time. And one of the things we need to do is start to teach our kids to the art of concentrating.
Well, speaking of the art of concentrating, talk about the ability to sort of think before acting, because that's more than just paying attention, because that gets to sort of the question we start out with today: why do smart kids do dumb things?
Exactly, and now we're going to focus in very specifically on the teenage brain. We made a mistake for a long time about the teenage brain, and the mistake that we made was thinking that it was finished all its physical development. Now, the reason we made that mistake is size. So earlier in our conversation today, we were talking about newborn babies. Well, a newborn baby, newborn baby's brain weighs on average about 3/4 of a pound, tripling in size in 1 year. So none of us have any trouble imagining all of the growth that's going on inside those little noggins. Well, that growth continues until about the age of 12, when the brain reaches its full size. So we thought that meant all the physical development was done. And then we attributed teenage behavior to two things: lack of experience and, of course, the famous hormones. Well, it turns out that that's not correct. The brain science now helps us understand that even though the teenage brain doesn't increase in mass, it is actually undergoing major rewiring. And one of the areas that enters its growth spurt as a boy or girl enters adolescence, the event called puberty, is an area of the brain just above the eyes, right behind the forehead, called the prefrontal cortex. It is the executive center of the brain. It is the part of the brain where we think ahead to consider consequences. It is the part of the brain where we assess risk. Well, it turns out that that part of the brain is undergoing major rewiring as boys and girls go through the teenage years. So when very smart kids do very stupid things, the answer to the question, why do smart kids do stupid things, has nothing to do with the thinking part of their brain. That part of the brain is absolutely fine. What's under construction, what's out to lunch, so to speak, is the impulse control center of the brain, the part of the brain that helps them assess risk. And so, you know, when smart kids do stupid things and you say, well, what were you thinking? When they say, well, I wasn't thinking, actually, they're right. The impulse part of the brain, the emotional part of the brain, kind of took charge and overrode the thinking, considered judgment part of the brain, which is now we understand much better why do they act that way.
So as a parent, are there sort of frameworks or guidelines that we can put on them, or is it just sort of consequences after they do something crazy?
Great question. If a teenager heard what I just said, a teenager might say, well, see, you can't hold me responsible. It's what's going on in my brain. Well, excuse and explanation might be close in the dictionary, but they're not the same thing. And so we can't let this explanation function as an excuse. Why? Because of what we talked about a half an hour ago. Experiences that we have during the growth spurt of the brain have a bigger impact than at any other time during my life. So we don't just let the clock run out and, you know, wait for their prefrontal cortex to mature. What we have to make sure that we do is give them plenty of experiences where they are learning to assess risk, where they're learning to manage impulses. And so that's where the whole limits and consequences comes in. You know, part of the art of parenting is, loosening up as kids get older, but not letting go. And that's important because, what teenagers are doing, and it's developmentally appropriate, what teenagers are doing during those years is they're asking for a divorce. And the request for divorce sounds like this: get off my back. Leave me alone. Nobody else's parents are like you. Well, the mistake that some parents are making is they are granting the divorce that their kids are asking for, because they still need that connection and they still need those limits and consequences. Maybe not the same way they did when they were 5 years old, but they still need limits and consequences. And that really turns out to be the most effective way to deal with these adolescent kind of arguments that go back and forth. I'll give you an example. My kids, like yours, are now adults, but I still remember the conversation with my son Dan, who's the oldest of my three. He's now 38 years old and has three of his own children, and is a great dad. But when he was about 17 years old, he had his driver's license, and we allowed him on occasion to use the family car. And so there was some big social event coming up on a Saturday night, and so Dan started earlier in the week to talk about curfew. Well, his idea of curfew and ours, my wife and mine, was quite different. So we'd have these discussions, and then finally I would listen to his reasoning and say, Dan, I'm sorry, the curfew is still 11 o'clock. And he would argue for a later curfew. We'd say, no, 11 o'clock is reasonable. You're 17 years old. So the day comes when he's going to go out. So it's Saturday. And as he's getting the keys, he said, what time do I have to be home? So I said, well, Dan, we've discussed this five times in the last 2 days. You need to be home at 11 o'clock. His response was, well, that's stupid. None of my friends have to be home at 11 o'clock. I said, well, I'm sorry, but your curfew is 11 o'clock. And he said, well, I'm not coming home at 11 o'clock. And I said, Dan, now this is where the limits and consequences come in. I said, Dan, remember, okay, just remember that if you choose, and this is your choice, if you choose not to be home at 11 o'clock, then you are choosing not to be able to use the car for the next 3 weeks. As he went out the door, the last thing he said was, I don't care, I'm not coming home at 11 o'clock. Now, between 7 o'clock when he went out and that later that night, I didn't know what time he was going to come home, but what time do you think he came home? 11 o'clock. Because once he calmed down, he realized that, you know, the pleasure of staying out an extra hour was not worth the misery of not being able to use the car for almost a month. And this is what's key. He knew that I would do it. And so that's why consistency and clarity become so important in dealing with teenagers. And avoiding these power struggles by just making it clear, if you choose to do that, then you are also choosing to get this.
It, you know, as I was reading the book and just as you were talking, it reminded me that I'm sure – you know, there's been a time or 10 where I said words that I wish that I wouldn't have. But I'm wondering about, do words of praise or criticism impact an adolescent brain more than we realize?
Boy, yes, absolutely. And you know, there, you might be aware, having read that part of the book, that there's a whole new body of research, particularly on how we praise kids. And a lot of times, with the best of intention, we praise kids whether they needed it or not. And it turns out that praising kids for effort is actually more helpful to them than praising them for an innate ability. So, for example, rather than saying, my gosh, you're really smart, it's actually more helpful to say, hey, way to work on those math problems. You put in a really good effort. Way to go. Because they can control the effort. That's where they've got control. They can't necessarily control the underlying innate ability, but what they can control is the effort. So how we reinforce and praise our kids can be either more helpful or less helpful to them as well. And, you know, criticism is part of learning. You know, we make mistakes, and so criticism is being held accountable for our mistakes. So you made a poor choice, and so this is going to be the consequence. That is all part of the experiences that help build that risk assessment and impulse control and character development, really, is what we're talking about. And, you know, we could easily translate this into moral and spiritual development as well.
We'll talk more about it and invite your questions as well. We have some time yet with our guest today, Dr. David Walsh. It's 877-933-2484 if you'd like to join in the conversation. 877-933-2484. And we do have a copy of David's book to give away, Why Do They Act That Way? It's a survival guide to the adolescent brain for you and your teen. It was updated here just this past year. It's one of his bestsellers. He's also written Know, Why Kids of All Ages Need to Hear It and Ways Parents Can Say It. That's a classic book, too. I recommend that. David is founder of Mind Positive Parenting, and you can find out more about his writing and the activities at drdavewalsh.com. We'll talk more about teen brain development in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Dear younger me, where do I start? If I could tell you everything that I have learned so far, then you could be one step ahead.
Well, we're trying to be a step ahead as parents, maybe two steps if that would work out. We're talking about a survival guide to the adolescent brain for you and your teen. That's the subtitle of David Walsh's book called Why Do They Act That Way? And you can find out more about the writings of Dave Walsh on his website, drdavewalsh.com, drdavewalsh.com. He's a best-selling author and really a leading authority in areas of child and teen development and the impact of technology in children's health. He He founded the National Institute on Media and Family. I think where we first connected with him over the years, and now recently directing Mind Positive Parenting. He and his wife have three adult children and now seven grandchildren, and giving us some great insight today. I want to talk, David, about the brain development as it relates to maybe healthy stress and depression in teens. It seems like we're hearing a lot more about, you know, depression, and obviously mood swings are a part of it. So, but is there more to it than that?
Yeah, there really is. You know, stress, one of the ways to look at stress is that not all stress is bad, by the way. What we need a certain amount of stress, you know, so if I have a deadline coming up, you know, there's a little bit of a procrastinator in many of us, there certainly is in me. And as the deadline starts to approach, that creates a certain amount of stress. Well, that stress can motivate me to get going. You know, I realize that we are just about a little bit less than a month away from tax time. Well, you know, I don't want to wait until April 14th to start to work on my taxes. That stress that it's now a little bit more than a month away motivates me to start to kind of pull some of my records together and get in gear. So not all stress is bad, but too much stress can be toxic because it can start to paralyze us. So what we want to do is look for that sweet spot. And so we don't want to remove all stress from our kids. You know what? Sometimes with the best of intentions, we think that our job as parents is to smooth out the road for our kids, remove all the bumps in the road. But that's not our job. Our job is to make sure that our kids come equipped with the shock absorbers so they can handle the bumps themselves. So we have to avoid bailing our kids out. We want to support our kids without coddling them. And we want to, you know, we want to encourage them without bailing them out. The so-called helicopter parent syndrome, where we're always swooping in to, you know, to help our kids out. On the other hand, we want to see if what we can do is to have, you know, kind of make sure we don't overdo it on the stress. So kids who get overscheduled, you know, the pressure to get into, in quotes, the right college, as if the right college is going to, you know, pave the way to, you know, to a successful life. It's the life skills, it's the habits, it's the character traits that are going to lead to success and happiness. So we don't want to load too much stress on. There is concern. About, and you brought this up in your question, there is concern about depression. I was just in a community, not here in the upper Midwest, but out in California, where I was invited to the community because they've experienced three teenage suicides just this past fall in one school district. And, of course, just rocking the community. And, teen suicide becomes, unfortunately, right behind accidents in terms of a leading cause of death for teenagers. So, you know, we do need to take this this whole issue of mental health of teenagers seriously, which is not easy to do, because when you consider what the average teenager looks like, it's hard sometimes to distinguish the normal from the abnormal. You know, sometimes I tell parents, well, adolescence is a normally abnormal period of life, because there are these emotional roller coasters, there are these ups and downs. And so what you want to look for is, you know, not one indicator, but a cluster of indicators that persist over time. You know, so a teenager might come home on Tuesday and say, "Mom and Dad, I hate school. I don't have any friends." And then 2 days later, they're on top of the world because, you know, because they had a great lunch with some friends. And so the ups and downs are a little bit tricky for parents to kind of figure out, is this really a warning sign that I need to pay attention, or is this kind of the normal ups and downs? And it's not easy to do with adolescents, but it is important to be aware. And of course, being aware means staying connected. And as we talked about earlier, staying connected with teenagers is not the easiest thing to do because they're often pulling away.
Yeah. David, we've got about 5 minutes left. You mentioned just sort of in passing at the early part of the show about sleep. I'm wondering if maybe we can kind of come back to that, just some things that maybe some encouragement for parents that we can do to give our kids the best possible opportunity to really to develop good brain health.
You know, sleep, it turns out that sleep is very, very important for brain hygiene, so to speak. And, you know, a way to, if I can ask your listeners to consider two questions, okay? If I ask your listeners, do you remember what you had for dinner last night? My guess is practically every one of your listeners could probably tell you what they had for dinner last night. And then if I ask your listeners, do you remember what you had for dinner a year ago last night? Probably no one would, unless it was some special occasion. Now, when you think about that, that is really very, very helpful. Can you imagine how cluttered our brains would be if we remembered everything that we had eaten for the last year? Well, that, you know, that pruning away non-essential information is what happens during sleep. Sleep is spring cleaning for the brain every night, where we reinforce the things, the brain reinforces the things that are important to recall and prunes away the things that are unimportant. And so adequate sleep is very, very important for brain hygiene. It's very, very important for stable mood. They did this study in Germany. I don't know if they could have done this study in the U.S. with our, you know, the way we do research in terms of protecting kids, and I'm fully in favor of that. But they did this study in Germany where they actually got parents, and I think these were with sixth graders, they got parents to agree to keep their kids up an hour later than normal. So they were all kind of getting at least 1 hour less sleep than normal. And within 1 month, those kids had performed a full grade lower in the classroom. And so there's no question that sleep affects our ability to remember, our ability to pay attention, our mood stability. So sleep is very, very important. And the bad news is that every age group right now is not getting as much sleep as they need, and the most sleep-deprived group of all are the teenagers. Your teenagers, our teenagers, I should say, should be getting about 9 hours sleep a night. The national average, 7.5. And technology is part of this. So, you know, if kids are playing video games, until 10 o'clock at night, they're not going to fall asleep until 10:30 or 11. And so I think turning off the technology and starting to wind down before it's time to go to sleep are things that parents can do to help their kids to start to eliminate that sleep deficit.
We're at about 3 minutes and counting. We haven't talked about concussions or, legalizing marijuana, but you want to jump in on concussions a bit?
Yeah, you know, one of the, I think we're all learning as we go along, unfortunately, that concussions can have long-term consequences. And, particularly in the growing brain, young people's brains, and one of the areas of the brain that is particularly susceptible to damage is, once again, that executive center, that prefrontal cortex. And so it really becomes, helmets while biking and, the American Academy of Pediatrics, it's interesting. The American Academy of Pediatrics has been trying to get the soccer coaches of America to not have young kids head the ball. Because it turns out that even though heading the ball doesn't create a concussion, that constant repetition, we now know from research, can do damage to that very, very important part of the brain. But they can't get the coaches to go along with that because they want the kids to develop the skills. So we need to use this new brain research that we're developing, the things that we're learning about the brain, to take better care of this miracle that God has created and has given all of us to take good care of. And that means protecting the brain, that means getting adequate sleep, it means providing good fuel, and basically the recipe that is, fruits and vegetables and limiting the junk food. If we were to put together a toxic brain diet, it would be the American fast food diet, which is filled with sugar, simple carbohydrates, the things that do not make for a healthy brain. So sleep, nutrition, getting enough exercise, limiting the technology so that it's part of a balanced lifestyle. And then, of course, you know, giving our kids good example and holding them accountable, staying connected with them and loving them. And I guess maybe as we finish this conversation, we should remind ourselves that loving teenagers can be a delayed gratification activity. If we're looking for the reward when they're 15 or 16, we might be disappointed. If we get it, great, but count it as a bonus. The reward comes when those kids turn out to be the kind of adults that we can be proud of.
Mm. Well, good practical advice, as always, from Dr. David Walsh. And you can find out more about his great insight and advice on his website, drdavewalsh.com. Check it out, drdavewalsh.com. We'll put a link up on our website as well. And we also post the podcast of today's interview. So if you missed it, you can hear part of it, or hear it again, or pass it on to a friend. It's at myfaithradio.com. And then just click on Connecting Faith. The book is called Why Do They Act That Way? Dr. David Walsh, guest today.